Hello and welcome back. This is episode 129 of Africa Past and Present, the podcast about African history, culture, and politics. I'm your host, Peter Alagi. Due to the ongoing COVID pandemic, our world has been turned upside down. Here at Michigan State University, we shifted to remote learning in early 2020, and the campus has been transformed into a kind of post-apocalyptic landscape. The United States, as many of you know, has failed miserably in dealing with the pandemic. As we record this episode, 268,000 Americans have already died from COVID. 13.5 million people have tested positive. 20 million Americans are still filing for unemployment every month. Many schools remain closed, and the pandemic rages on, seemingly uncontrolled. In this gloomy scenario, many African countries have responded much more effectively and efficiently to the pandemic than the mighty USA. And I would add, African countries have become a real source of inspiration for many of us stuck in the global north. This recognition, together with exciting recent announcements of reliable COVID vaccines about to become available, finally motivated us to restart the podcast, albeit remotely. And so it is my pleasure today to introduce Dr. Chambi Chachage. He is an African Humanities Postdoctoral Research Associate and Lecturer at Princeton University. He earned his PhD in African Studies from Harvard University in 2018 and has a book manuscript under review entitled Africanizing Capital, Emergence of Black Entrepreneurs in Eastern Africa. His publications include Africa's Liberation, The Legacy of Nyerere, published with Pambazuka Press and co-edited with Anar Kassam in 2010. And chapters on Nyerere in Dorothy Huxon and Judith Byfield's edited book, Global Africa, University of California Press 2017, and both Dorothy Huxon and Judith Byfield were guests of the podcast earlier. And another essay on globalization and the making of East Africa's Asian entrepreneurship networks in Moses Ochunu's edited collection, Entrepreneurship in Africa, Indiana University Press 2018. Dr. Chachage has also published in the Codesria Bulletin, African Sociological Review, as well as popular websites like Africa is a Country and African Arguments. He is contributing editor of the Review of African Political Economy and editorial team member of the Sana Journal on African Arts, Media, and Cultures. He blogs at udadisi.com, that's UDADISI, and you can follow him on Twitter at Udadisi. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Peter.
I'd like to begin by asking you a little bit about yourself and your background. You grew up in Tanzania and then embarked on a journey that took you to South Africa, then to Scotland, and then finally to the United States. When did you know you wanted to become an academic?
That's a tricky question for me because there was a couple of shifts. I grew up in an academic family. My late father was a professor at the University of Dar es Salaam. So when I was a kid, I wanted to be a professor. And then later on, I changed my mind, and then I've come full circle now.
And your experience in South Africa, you studied at the University of Cape Town in very interesting times. How was that different from Tanzania, and how did you navigate that politically charged landscape?
Yeah, it was very different because when I was growing up in Tanzania, I was still in my teens. I was going to high school there. Virtually everybody was black. Of course, once in a while we met Europeans, but our life was really, really centered on African people, black people generally. But when I went to South Africa, there was a very, very significant shift because race was a very significant marker in South Africa. So suddenly racism became something that was quite visible in my daily life. But when I was a kid, there was a time I spent a year in Scotland when my dad was doing his PhD. So I did encounter some forms of racism and even violence. But then over the years, it went to the background. But then when I went to South Africa, then it was almost like a rekindling of that same kind of experience that I had in South Scotland as a kid. So that was at a personal level. But even at the university, I ended up engaging with a lot of scholarship on race and racism, reading the likes of Fanon, the likes of Steve Biko's, who in a significant way shaped my thinking about race and racism at a global level.
And in your experience, how much did South African students know about Tanzania?
So it was in the late 90s and early 2000s, so almost like five, six years after the new South Africa. And what I can recall is that almost every group stuck to themselves. So like Tanzanian student at UCT will be on their own. South African colors will be on their own. So we didn't have much of the interaction except in some of the associations. Like I belong to some of the church associations. So there somehow we had to mingle because people were coming from different nations as well as different race and ethnicities. And from my understanding, not a lot of people knew about Tanzania, but we are the one who made them know, or maybe somebody will know somebody who studied a year before me. So when you talk to them, it's like, oh, I knew somebody from Tanzania, so and so and so. But sometimes you also heard that line, that classical South African line, that we wish to go to Africa proper. So for them, Tanzania right. And other places were Africa proper, and South Africa was not really Africa proper.
Yes, that South African exceptionalism. In football, I always laugh when I hear players or coaches, for example, or sometimes even reporters say, you know, when, say, Kaiser Chiefs or Mamelodi Sundowns have to go play in an African competition, they say, yeah, we have to go to Africa to play. And then, so you were an African studies scholar also at Edinburgh University, which has a venerable tradition, right, in African studies, with also a long-standing history of welcoming Black students from the Caribbean, as well as from Africa, going back to the early 20th century. And how was that experience for you? How did that then transform you from Tanzania and from South Africa?
Edinburgh was exciting for me because that's a place where our first president, Mwalim Julius Nyerere, went to school. But when I arrived there, the Center for African Studies was going through some sort of a transition. They were changing the courses that I was interested in taking. The financial situation was not as great. They were not as stable as they are now. So it was a little bit difficult. And we were basically two African students. Actually, initially, I was the only one. And then later on, an Ethiopian student joined us. So it was a very difficult transition to me. But again, just like the way it was in South Africa, I managed to find communities beyond the university, especially in my church associations. And in those communities, you meet people from all over the African diaspora, all over the world, people from as far as Jamaica, people from Zimbabwe. So in a way, that's what kept me going on. Of course, there was also a Swahili club that was run by a professor who had spent some time in Tanzania in the late 70s, early 80s. Professor Trafts Lomax. So in a way, that society also helped. And then we had a Tanzanian society in Edinburgh. So it is really the environment outside the university that really, really made a difference for me. But of course, we had good professors. Some of them, I'm still in touch with them. They're on Twitter. We're exchanging a lot of information and insights. So academically, theoretically, there was a lot of things I learned, but in terms of the environment, it was really a very white setup situation for me at that time.
It's fascinating to hear the importance of these Pan-African networks of support and of solidarity, and how, you know, they often are really what enables scholars from the continent to survive and thrive in challenging circumstances. From Edinburgh, you went to Harvard. You studied with Professor Achampong and Professor Sven Beckert, of course, and that formed the basis of your exciting book manuscript on the history and culture of Dar es Salaam's African entrepreneurial class. And having read your doctoral dissertation, I'm so impressed with the way in which you covered such a long period of time, dating back to the early colonial phase in the late 19th century, and then into the socialist period of Nyerere and Ujamaa, and then even bringing up to the contemporary era, which you define as post-socialism. And you mention in this kind of revisionist account of Dar es Salaam and of Tanzania that the city itself is in Dar es Salaam is set to reach 10 million residents by 2030. It's really a remarkable explosion, demographic explosion that we're seeing in a city that is relatively new. I grew up in a city that's now almost 2,800 years old in Rome, Italy. So when I see a settlement that's 130, 140 years old, I call that new. For Americans, it's quite old, of course. But I was fascinated by the way you looked at sources and archives in multiple countries, newspapers, and also how you presented biographies that in the manuscript do such a nice job of historicizing the lives of this elite. Unpacking their social relations, their place in sort of the institutions that they occupied, and also how they related to other social classes and people in the city. So can you tell us about the role of this African entrepreneurial class, what some scholars used to call the bourgeoisie, maybe Walter Rodney at the University of Dar es Salaam in particular. Others, even more critical, would call them even a compradorial class. And how did this set of entrepreneurs shape Tanzanian history?
So before I answer that, I need to give a little bit of a background connected to earlier question about my journey. So as I said earlier, when I grew up at the University of Dar es Salaam, and as you probably know, the academic tradition in the 70s, 80s, was dominated by the Marxist scholars, and my dad basically was a Marxist scholar, so that's the kind of environment I grew up, and those are the kind of ideologies that to a significant extent I either subscribed to or I was sympathetic to. So when I went to South Africa, then I got myself into so much engagement with race, post-colonial theories, and so forth. There were not so much of Marxism at that time. But for my project now, my final project at UCT, I realized at that time that I spent so much time understanding South Africa. Almost all my essays in school were about South Africa. So I started almost going back home, trying now to understand more about Tanzania. And then I did a project, what we call an honors thesis, on South African foreign direct investment in Tanzania using the case of Shoprite. At that time, we had a number of Shoprite outlets in Tanzania and other Southern African countries. And then that's when I realized I really want to write the history of Tanzania, but through the history of capitalism. But then I went to the US as an exchange student at that time. I was at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, work with a Marxist professor, Professor Brassey, where we read the likes of Ciara James. And in a way, I got that foundation that I needed, but I couldn't. But at that time, I didn't know about the academic calendar in the US in terms of applications for grad school. So I was a little bit late in my application. That's how I ended up going to the UK. But I was also excited about the UK because there was a development studies aspect into African studies more than race at that time compared to the US and even South Africa. So from there onward, my interest was how will I find somebody to work with at a graduate level to write a history of Tanzania through the history of capitalism vis-a-vis socialism. But I couldn't find anyone at the time, went back home, worked as an activist in educational NGOs, which in a way also shaped the foundation that I will bring into this PhD dissertation of mine, because in that particular NGO called Haki Elimu, one of our focus was the role of Nyerere in education in Tanzania and liberation and so forth. So now when I come to Harvard, yes, it seems to be a liberal institution. It seems to be a basically capitalist institutions. But then I realized there was a group of people who were already studying capitalism at that time. They were so excited about it. And this is a group led by Professor Sven Beckett. Of course, the main focus for them initially was American capitalism and then later on global capitalism. But I managed to find a group of people who were really, who provided some sort of a niche for me to work on my project. And then later on, I managed to connect Professor Champong, who also know literally about everything in Africa. So that background is important because my approach in this particular project was an attempt to write about something that Marxist scholars, such as Issachiv G, my dad himself, have tried to write, but I wanted to write it in a way that it will also give room for us to also learn and understand how these, what I call entrepreneurial elites, also dealt with the issues of race in the context of capitalism. This was important for me because I could have simply said, I'm going to write a critical Marxist dissertation that is going to focus on the issue of labor, how they are treating their workers, how they are reproducing their capital, how they are reproducing inequalities. But I felt this, in a way, this has already been done. The only thing that I'll be doing is to just update it. So that's why I decided to take this angle of looking at their role from their own vantage point of view, but also in relation to other international organizations such as the World Bank and the USAID, which were also promoting entrepreneurship, especially during the transition from socialist Tanzania to post-socialist Tanzania. So what I would say that indeed they had played a significant role in trying to shape some of the policies that are associated with capitalism and the private sector in Tanzania. And in a way, they've also played a role in shaping the dynamic and spatial configuration of Dar es Salaam in the sense that they've also participated in constructing sites or locating themselves in some of those sites that are associated with the way Dar es Salaam is developed as a city that is demarcated racially as well as in terms of industrial clusters and other clusters in the city.
Right, and one of the exciting things that you do in the work is you really challenge conventional notions of the history of private enterprise in Tanzania, and you could say East Africa more broadly, you know, as being only the purview of Indians and Europeans, mm-hmm. By focusing on Black businessmen in particular. And I liked how at the end you also zeroed in on the more contemporary period, and you kind of offer a revisionist account of the process of privatization, which, you know, of course you critique very effectively, but you depart from, you know, how not just Marxists, but other scholars have seen it essentially as imposed from outside and from above. And you kind of come at it from the side, if you will. You talk about, of course, super wealthy entrepreneurs like Ali Mufuruki and Reginald Mengi and so on, who even I think was on the cover of Forbes magazine at some point. You mentioned South African companies setting up franchises like Woolworths. I think you mentioned ShopRite just before. What's different about the way you looked at the history of privatization in Tanzania? What does it reveal to you about the nature and impact of this process in the country and the region?
Mm-hmm. So I totally agree with part of the conventional critique of privatization as a move that emerged out of the neoliberal policies and the neoliberal reforms. But the angle that I'm trying to introduce as somebody who believes in intersectionality as a theoretical framework, I know people tend to use it simply when they're looking at the issue of women in relation to gender and class and other categories. But I think it's also a framework, even though I don't explicitly state it, but it's also a framework that can also help understand situation where the issue, I mean, a situation where men are also involved, but race is a significant category in that particular case. So conventional critiques, they tend to really provide a class analysis of this of privatization in terms of the ruling class, either in collaboration with international capitalist class to promote privatization, or like other the commercial class, which has been dominated by the people of Asian origin in Tanzania. But I also felt that race is a significant category in this battle for privatization, because some of these black entrepreneurs or entrepreneurs of African origins, they are also trying to use this moment, the privatization moment, to also accumulate capital and undo some of the racial dynamics that have been there in the case of large-scale industrialization and black business being dominated by either European or people of Asian descent. So in a way, for me, that was a particular angle that I was adding. But overall, I'm still a critic of privatization, especially the way it was carried in Tanzania, because people got away with a lot of industries and companies that the state has managed to build, either from the scratch or through nationalization in the past. And some of these people who ended up getting these private entities, they didn't even develop them. In some cases, we even had entities that were more successful during the socialist period than during the privatization period or the post-socialist period. So that's what I was really trying to bring there on the table, because my overall thesis is really about how entrepreneurs of African descent have been struggling with race from the pre-colonial to the colonial to the socialist, all the way to the post-socialist times. So sometimes my work become maybe misunderstood. I mean, that could be a wrong word, because people are free to have their own understanding. But sometimes it's misunderstood in the sense that I appear as if I'm an apology of capitalism or privatization and this and so forth. But for me, I just felt that we needed an account that will be as factual as possible, as accurate as possible, in trying to really show what really happened among this group of people in relation to some of these global dynamics that were happening in the case of the ascendance of global capitalism and neoliberalism. And I think that chapter on privatization, in a way, is the one that shifts my location back to the leftist orientation compared to other chapters. But I know if somebody read the dissertation and don't get to that chapter on privatization, it's very easy to say, oh, here goes another defender and promoter of capitalism and neoliberalism, which is not really the case.
That's very important to underscore. You certainly don't come across to me, at least, as an apologist. What I read really was a real interest and ability to put these diverse entrepreneurs kind of center stage and show how agency takes a lot of different forms. And, you know, people's aspiration for self-determination and ownership needs to be accounted for. There is a tendency, I think, in African studies and still today, I think, in African history, particularly the way it's done in the global north, to almost equate agency with various forms of resistance. You know, we're kind of still battling with the terms and ways of reading the past that we inherited from the 60s and 70s. And I think one of the most intriguing aspects of your work is that it really does a nice job of moving us beyond that. Now, speaking of being cutting edge, I mean, you are deeply involved in African digital humanities. I see that you're teaching a seminar at Princeton on health, race, and power in Africa in the digital age. And of course, you're extremely active on Twitter. I don't think there's another African studies scholar who has nearly 80,000 followers like you do. And you also blog quite actively at udadisi.com. How would you say digital technologies and social media, perhaps in particular, shape and continue to shape your African studies scholarship and even teaching?
So in a way, I tend to see myself, this is more of a past tense. So I used to look at myself more of a practitioner in the sense that I started blogging more than 10 years ago, before I even started my PhD. At that time, I was not really thinking of going to grad school. I was working, as I said earlier, when I was working in Tanzania as an NGO policy analyst and activist. And then later on, I became an independent scholar. That's when I was actively blogging. And then I joined Twitter reluctantly later on. And then I got hooked into it after some advice from my friend that I really need to use that space because of the kind of knowledge that I was producing. And then I had an opportunity to write an article for a journal on development published by Palgrave about, again, 10, 11 years ago. And at that time, the article that I opted to write about was about blogging for social change, because at that time there was a lot of hype about blogging for social change. And I'd also been invited to the University of Edinburgh again to my alma mater for a conference on ICTs. So that was the moment when I started now starting to bridge what I was practicing on social media and my own theoretical thinking. But I had no idea that what I was doing was part of digital humanities. That came much, much later when I was thinking of organizing this conference that I organized this year on African digital humanities. So that was a time when I really started understanding the field. And when the pandemic came up, there was a suggestion from some professors at Princeton that if I could design a new class that connects issues of health, the pandemic, and digital unrest, which were already things that I was working on. So in a way, I would say, yes, social media has really shaped my thinking, because especially Twitter, because it's a space where a lot of scholars, theorists, and critics prefer, probably more than Facebook and other platforms. So I get a chance to interact with them, both senior scholars and junior upcoming scholars. It's also a good outlet for sharing information about publication, about events. And in a way, it's also a good source for teaching. So for this class that I was teaching, for instance, I was trying to curate every week the way Africa was represented on Twitter when it comes to the pandemic, to COVID-19. And you could see there was a lot of tweets and articles that were produced and generated through Twitter and other platforms, all connected. So there could be an article on Facebook or an article on Medium on the pandemic in Africa or New York Times, and then you'd find itself on Twitter. And in a way, we got a chance to, my student got a chance to do group projects, and they were using this kind of sources. And a lot of information and knowledge came out of that. So for me, I see a lot of symbiotic relationship between the two platforms. But overall, still, it does not substitute the traditional role or task of scholars to read journal articles, to read books, to analyze them, to write articles, to produce books and articles. But it connects the two very, very well.
That's so important to appreciate that the analog and the digital should be in dialogue with each other. And this really came out so nicely at the African Digital Humanities Conference that you organized at Princeton recently. Of course, due to the pandemic, we met online. I had the great privilege of participating in the event. Thank you for inviting me. And I was so impressed with many things, including the number of Africa scholars that participated from so many different disciplines. I mean, humanities, I think, was properly defined in a very generous way, in a very capacious, flexible way. They also represented many different regions, including the diaspora. We heard an important keynote by the Cameroonian scholar, Evelyn Fogwa-Chibaka. And then you had panels on theorizing and teaching, methods and sources, writing and publishing, and African DH. Now, you've had a few days to step back, and these conferences are really hard work. Mm-hmm. Did you come away with a sharper sense of how these digital humanities initiatives in Africa in particular are starting to reconfigure the field of African studies?
Yeah, I would say yes, because when I was initially organizing the conference a year ago, because it was supposed to be held in May here at Princeton, and it didn't work out because of the pandemic, I spent a lot of time trying to research who are the African digital humanities scholars, especially Africans. So it was a really difficult task for me at that time to get names, but I managed to get names, and then some names I stumbled on them later on, because it was a conference by invitation rather than a conference by call for papers. So it means I had to go out on my way to really, really find the participants. And for me, I think probably one of the most interesting discovery was the discovery of the keynote speaker, because she had been invited to Germany to give a keynote address there. And then her video was there online. And then I watched it and I was like, yeah, this is exactly what we need. But as far as I know, she was not known that much on this, on the American, among American digital humanities scholars. And I kept getting questions, you know, like, who's this? What should we anticipate? And I'm glad that she came, she gave that talk. It made people realize, oh, we have African scholars who are at the heart of these things. They're theorizing. They are having initiatives as far as Cameroon, because as you know, they are the traditional African countries when it comes to digital humanity, South Africa, and then Nigeria, and then Kenya.
Sure.
So probably people are expecting a keynote from South Africa, from Nigeria, or from Kenya, and then suddenly you are getting a keynote from Cameroon, and she's deep into these things. And then if you can recall, you see that a lot of these talks, they also talked about the connection that they were already forging in Africa. So some of them already knew each other. They were already forging these connections. So in a way, this was more of a space now to bring those connection into a probably wider interconnection within Africa and the diaspora itself. Because I'm one of those people who look at Africa as beyond the continent, beyond the geographical limitation of the continent. So I'm looking at it in terms of Africa and its diaspora. It's more of an Pan-African approach. I'm not looking at it as a sub-Saharan Africa. So I really wanted people from all over the place, as far as North Africa, as far as the Caribbeans, and that's why you ended up having that kind of a mix in that particular conference. And one of the things that I also observed is that actually these networks were enhanced, because I noticed that the keynote now was invited to Nigeria to a summer school there on digital humanities, and she was invited, I think, by someone who didn't, I think he didn't know her before. So for me, that was like, wow, this is exactly what I wanted, to deepen the interconnections, but also to make people seriously think about digital humanities as a field in its own right, where people theorize, where people think about how to publish, how to archive. And I think the presentation did justice to that, because we saw serious work, archival work, digitized archival work, 3D dimensions, and all applications of technologies into digital humanities. And another interest was to show that it does not end with the humanities and social sciences. And that's why I had to showcase that initiative from the new professor of computer science at Princeton, Dr. Aji Dieng, because she's a computer scientist, but she has decided to start an initiative called The Africa I Know, to connect historians, technologists, scientists in shaping a positive narrative of Africa. So that helps people see that this is not simply about people who are in the English department, people who are in the history department. It's beyond that. And we need those kind of connections if we really want to push African digital humanities forward and bridge the digital divide.
Very important point. I find sometimes that the scientists are the best equipped, really, to collaborate with. But, you know, academic silos remain significant factors in keeping us apart. In fact, one of the things I thought about as the conference was unfolding was we've really moved beyond the initial phase of the first sort of wave of DH projects in Africa. We're now kind of starting to see both a kind of maturing of the field, but also increasing specialization. Mm-hmm. And that has its advantages and its disadvantages, particularly because it's such an interdisciplinary enterprise, this of you know, this broadly defined digital humanities. And we as individual scholars, you know, still operate in departments and units that are very much disciplinary. There's this tension. How do you see then, how can this tension be resolved? The interdisciplinarity of DH versus the enduring, from a practical level, certainly disciplinarity of much of academia.
So for me, I think the first step is mutual respect, because traditionally you have disciplines that feel they are more better than others. They have more intelligent people. They have more difficult tasks than others. And then you have the other side, which feel the other ones are more inhuman, more detached from reality. So I think mutual respect on both sides, I mean, across the discipline, is important. And again, probably I'm over-publicizing the Africa I know, but I think it captures that, because this is a computer scientist who feels you need a historian to run part of a project. So it means she has respect for history to know that she can't handle everything by herself as a computer scientist. And judging from the readings that we've been reading in my class and some of the guest lecturers that we've been inviting, you can see that even people who have been writing about race and technology, they've also made use of the expertise of computer scientists and programmers. Some of them had to go and learn programming either by themselves or through the support and expertise of computer scientists and programmers. So when you have that mutual respect and realization that we are more interdependent than independent when it comes to pushing some of these things, it becomes possible. Probably you're aware of the new initiative at UCT it's called HUMA, H-U-M-A, where they're trying to integrate again humanities with the fourth industrial revolution, the artificial intelligence. And you can sense that level of respect that we need to center humanities into this. But you can also see the acknowledgement that we need also the expertise of people who are familiar with artificial intelligence and people who are familiar with the post industrial revolution from a scientific or technological point of view. So I think that that's the first step. I'm coming from a country where since you are in like in school back then, you always have this hierarchy, like scientists feel they are better than people who are doing history and English. I was a science student. I remember that time one of the reasons why I was very good at history, but I wanted to do science because I felt I'm not going to be respected, you know. But later on, of course, I shifted from science, ended up in history, but I still have a lot of that science baggage, which in a way helps me in a lot of things that I'm doing now. And I'm grateful that I ended up taking all these classes along the way at UCT and other places. So I don't look down at English or history or computer science, because I know all of them are important in digital humanities.
These are all really valuable insights. And obviously, this is an ongoing project. We're just starting these kinds of deep collaborations. And I liked how your conference in the end really Despite all of these different disciplines represented and different approaches, regions, et cetera, they all seem to agree that there are, you know, the key to moving forward is a recognition that you need to invest in people. You know, that there's often an assumption that these technology programs are about hardware or software, but the really significant factor, the variable that makes them work or not, is people. And of course, this means that there are costs involved, and the presentations by the librarians and archivists, be they in the analog world or the digital world, or those who cross over, really underscored this. The importance of finding resources to properly preserve and access African sources and ideas is absolutely crucial. And the ethic of sharing, that we are producing knowledge, but what is good is this knowledge if we're just hoarding it on our hard drives and using it only for individual purposes? And that the international partnerships that many of the presenters were part of were both exciting, but also offering some lessons of caution on how to proceed, that you really need to make sure that it is African researchers and institutions that are equal partners and benefiting from these partnerships, that they don't fall into the typical extractive relationships that are often associated with global North institutions and scholars operating on the continent. So I think that was an incredibly productive sort of emerging consensus that came out of it. We have just a little bit of time left, and I want to throw you a really tough question before we go, and that has to do with the recent elections in Tanzania. I'm not going to draw you out too much, but you know, there was so much concern about what happened in the buildup to the vote just a few weeks ago. And of course, the outcome was the incumbent president, John Magufuli, being reelected with what, more than 84% of the vote, and CCM winning for the, I think, sixth consecutive time since multi-party elections began in the early 1990s. There were widespread reports of intimidation of political opponents, harassment, even internet shutdowns, and incidents of violence. So there was a report by Tanzania Elections Watch, which I read, which pretty much confirmed, although, you know, the evidence sometimes was more circumstantial, all of these allegations, and the UN echoed some of these. What's your, say, Twitter take on the election? Because we don't have 2 hours to go into all of the details. What does this mean for Tanzania's future?
Yeah, so the way I look at it is in terms of the dichotomy between precedents and what is unprecedented. So there are certain things that were already precedented. Virtually all our election have had a lot of problems, a lot of complaints about vote rigging and so forth. A lot of people complained about the state. I mean, the ruling party using state resources to win the elections. And a lot of interference at a lot of levels. In the case of Zanzibar, we've already had cases of post-election violence, even election violence in 2000, 2001. So what makes this election peculiar, in my humble opinion, is that it has set some new precedents that were not there. So the first one, for instance, is the way it interfered with the internet. So there was some form of internet shutdown that was happening. So people couldn't access WhatsApp, Twitter, which are some of the key tools among Tanzanians to communicate issues of politics and other and related matters. People had to resort to VPN. So for me, that in itself sent a whole new precedent that if the ruling party and the state could go as far as setting that new precedent, then it really means things were really, really, really at a very, very, at a different scale compared to the past.
And of course, if you look again at the nature of the outcome of the elections, again, it's also really unprecedented. In multi-party election in Zanzibar, you always have about 50-50. It's always virtually 50-50. So somebody will get 40-something percent, another one will get 50-something percent. So when you get this kind of result, you're like, where did this come from? And then we know, like, members of the opposition, they tend to win a couple of seats. And then you are having, especially the main opposition party, Chadema. And now you're in a situation where virtually all members of Chadema don't even win a single seat, except one particular seat that a woman won in one of the constituents, which even made people wonder, was it really... did she really win, or the state just decided let's allow this as a token or something like that? So even those places where we know they are stronghold of the opposition, CCM, the ruling party, won. And then you are having the numbers, the percentage that the current president got, it adds to the question mark, because people would have expected maybe it would have been something like 60-40, and not that, because the trend has always been going up over the years. So it's, for some of us observers, it's like, it's just a sad situation whereby multi-party democracy was somehow thriving. It was more of a positive trajectory. Now we are almost back to square one.
Well, we'll have to leave it at that. I want to thank you, Dr. Chambi Chachage, for a wide-ranging conversation and excellent insights on Tanzanian history, culture, and politics. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Africa Past and Present is a co-production of Matrix, the Center for Digital Humanities and Social Sciences, and the Department of History at Michigan State University. Technical support is provided by the Matrix Digital Media Lab. You can stream and download all episodes on our website, afropod.aodl.org. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts and Google Podcasts. To get in touch, send email to Alegi, that's A-L-E-G-I, at msu.edu. Thanks for listening.